If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at OnePeloton.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Borderlines, a podcast for the discussion of Canadian immigration law. I'm Stephen Murins. Today, Deanna and I are joined by Christina Gita, an immigration lawyer who practices at Green and Spiegel in Toronto. Christina is one of the authors of the book Temporary Entry into the Canadian Labor Market by Emon Publishing. The topic of today's episode is when you can work without a work permit in Canada. We discuss what a work permit is, when it is needed, and exemptions from work permits. Some of these exemptions include business visitors, the global skills strategy, religious workers, public speakers, maintained status, people working for or people waiting for postgraduate work permits, and more. If you want to contact Gita, you can email her at christinag@gns.com, so christinag@gands.com. If you would like to contact me, you can email me at steven.meurrens@larlee.com, and Deanna can be reached at deanna@mccrealaw.ca. If you like the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes, and I hope you enjoy today's episode. What I have before me, given to me by Emon Publishing, is the book Temporary Entry into the Canadian Labor Market, which, Christina, you are a part editor of, along with Stephen Green, Alexandra Cole, and Peter Salerno. And What we are discussing today is when you can work in Canada without a work permit. I think all of us have active work permit practices, as well as other areas of immigration law. And the starting point is, why and when do you need a work permit? What are the consequences if you're working without a work permit? And when can you actually work without a work permit?
So why you're being a bit generous to say that I have an active work permit practice, but I'll take the
caregivers work.
Yeah, they work. Yeah. I usually am dealing with them when they're being told that they are not allowed to do that anymore. But yeah, I take your point. Yeah.
So why don't we dive in with what the definition of work is under immigration law?
So I mean, the definition under the regulations is essentially if you're earning wages or commission for the activities that you're taking part in while in Canada. And it, in essence, is what you're doing directly competing with what a Canadian or permanent resident could do. That's the literal definition of it. But what I typically explain to my clients is what are the activities that you're doing in Canada and are you being paid for those activities? So if you're entering the Canadian labor market and essentially they're looking at you and they're looking at a Canadian or permanent resident saying, can these two individuals or these two groups of people be doing the same thing? Then that's work. That's the easiest way I usually explain it to my clients.
Clients always, their immediate ask is, well, mm-hmm. they look to kind of get around the role of remuneration. Yeah. Can't I be paid a stipend? Can't I be paid in another country? Mm-hmm. You know, what if they just defer paying me for a period of time and then I get a bonus later? And mm-hmm. so how do you respond to those sorts of situations?
It's about your activities. So if it competes directly with the activities of a Canadian or a permanent resident. So if you're working and the typical example I have is the CEO saying they're coming in to do, let's say, business meetings, right? So I say to them, if you're doing a business meeting and you guys are just talking the quarterlies, that's one thing. But if you're doing your activities that you would typically do as a CEO, so overseeing, you know, the operation, providing, you know, recommendations, meeting with your managers, your day-to-day activities, that's work. And that requires a work permit. So that's usually the easiest way. Money aside, it's always about the activities. And that seems to be what clients understand the most, because we all know, you know, remuneration and all of that. There's different ways of, as you've identified, of doing it, but it's really what they're actually doing while they're in Canada is the really the crux of the test.
Yeah. And that, I mean, we discussed in the last podcast episode with Marina on myths in Canadian immigration, and that was one of the myths she identified, that volunteer work is still work under Canadian immigration legislation. Mm-hmm. As far as those activities that compete directly with, the IRCC website has a whole web page that tries to break down when is it an activity that competes directly with Canadians, when isn't it? And so I'm sure we've dealt with like all of these or some of these. The big ones, and another one that comes up a lot, are internships, or people ask, mm-hmm. well, if it's work that's just done for obtaining work experience, is that work? Yes. Mm-hmm. Foreigners coming to repair machines or fulfill contracts, even if they're paid abroad, is that work? Yes. And then there's this list of activities that IRCC does not consider to be work. And I'll just go through some of them. I mean, the big one is an activity which does not really take away from opportunities for Canadians or permanent residents to gain employment or experience in the workplace. So it gives some examples of that. And one that I'm curious to know how you've relied on it is that you do not need a work permit because it's not considered work if you're doing long distance by telephone or internet work done by a temporary resident whose employer is outside Canada and who is remunerated from outside Canada. So mm-hmm. how often do you come across, or what are the scenarios where you see that apply?
Well, I mean, in COVID work from home era that we've all just kind of, we're still working through, that question came up all the time, especially as the borders closed and family members or, you know, couples that were on either side of the border didn't have the ease of travel. One of them would go to the other side and typically to Canada and work for their, let's say, US employer remotely. And my answer to that has always been, if anything you're doing is for anyone outside of Canada, I'm okay with that. But if a client ends up being a client in Canada, or you start getting, you know, a Canadian involved in, let's say, a contract or something like that, that's when the line gets a little bit gray. Mm-hmm. So that was a big thing, especially for self-employment, because online it always talks about self-employment. So I always have freelancers that say, well, I'm not working. All my clients are outside of Canada. And I say, okay, that's fine. But I said, do you work with anyone in Canada? And then by asking those questions, it came out that one of the people that she was freelancing for, there was a connection in Canada. And at that point I said, that's work. It's going to get gray. If someone asks you a question, you're going to have issues. So that's, I'm okay with remote work as long as there's a very clear line that it's not entering the Canadian labor market. It's not involving a Canadian customer or client, etc.
It gets super tricky when there's like e-commerce type, because sometimes people, I've had, often this comes up in the context of a spousal where, somebody will be traveling to visit their Canadian spouse. And I just remember one case where the spouse was like, she ran a consulting business and all of her clients, like it was done a lot of it remotely and all of her business was attracted through her website. Just putting in clearer things on the website where it was like, I cannot accept any business from any Canadian clients, to make sure that she wasn't going to be offside those work authorization rules, because, if a Canadian client came in, then that could really put her offside.
Absolutely. And it's about asking those questions, right? When that question comes to me, my automatic response is asking a series of other questions.
Yeah. Well, and I have probably, so the example that I have that I sent to the MREP's email address is if you have a YouTube channel that's monetized or a podcast with Patreon, if that counts as working, if you have a YouTube account and you upload videos in Canada, are you working? And what do you think MREP said?
I mean, I would think they said yes.
In my opinion, it's work. Yeah, I would say that. Would they say it?
They took the opinion that because there might be Canadians clicking and watching, you have Canadian clients.
I think it's sketchy, but at the same time, I think if you're looking out for your client's best interest, I would be worried about them coming in and putting themselves at the, I mean, ultimately it's about putting themselves at the mercy of a decision maker at the port of entry. And even if somebody at MREPS is like, yep, sounds good to me, I wouldn't want to have to represent them at an admissibility hearing if somebody takes a different position, because they're not bound by that previous opinion,
Exactly.
It does stretch, in my opinion, the definition of work to its extreme, because what are we really, in that example, protecting the Canadian labor market from what?
Well, so much of this, I mean, that's what I find with all of this conversation about work and the constraints of the work permit. We get pretty quickly into stretching the bounds of what can properly be regulated, like even just in terms of location of employment and name of employer, like they seem pretty obvious and pretty pretty confined on their face. But especially now with people working remotely, like you'll say the location of work. Well, does that mean if you go on a business trip and you're traveling to a different province, for a business meeting, does that mean you're working offside the conditions of your permit? If you've got an LMIA and it's registered to a particular location and all of a sudden you start remote working, does that mean that you're breaching the conditions of your work permit? So a lot of these things, there's a very logical kind of set of rules in terms of what the requirements are, what the conditions are on the face of your permit. And I think that there's also, I think that things just in the regular marketplace are becoming a little bit more nuanced than a work, than the regulation, than the work permit on its face can contain these days.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because the work permit, sorry to interrupt, Stephen. I mean, the work permit is, I think the definition of work, I think at the time this was considered we didn't have all of, as you said before, these nuances, this remote work, this, you know, YouTubers or influencers, you know, those things weren't considered. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. I'm sure someone will have litigation at some point that's going to give us a bit more clarity on these issues, for sure.
Yeah. For sure.
And I mean, and all of this, like the remote work, is really just a sentence on the IRCC website that could be edited at any point.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The other example they give of what is not work is unremunerated help by a friend or family member during a visit, such as a mother assisting a daughter with childcare or an uncle helping his nephew build his own cottage. Is this where you used to have litigation, Deanna, in terms of?
It is. It's also where I was cross-examined when I was getting qualified as an expert. Because so, we were, I mean, essentially, I will explain it a little bit. We were talking about, you know, some of, I mean, we were talking specifically about a lot of non-compliances, like, you know, when you'd look at the criminal sections of the act, it's not very clear, like, when a non-compliance is just a non-compliance and when any violation of the act is considered potentially criminal. So that was basically the subject matter of the litigation. And so essentially the subject matter of the testimony was that there are lots of very easy ways that somebody can fall into a non-compliance, not through, you know, committing some act of terrorism, but through doing something like helping out a friend or family member when they're in town, you know. And the point being made was, well, look, the website says that that would not be considered unauthorized work. But of course, this is just on a website. It's just policy. It's not enforceable. It's not actually part of the regulations that is not actually considered unauthorized work. And so this anyways ended up leading to a lot of questioning because, you know, so while the website says, you know, if you come and you do the dishes at your friend's house, that that's not considered to be unauthorized work. But at the same time, when you look at the strict definition of what work is, like, why would it not be? And if somebody decided to take you to task and say you worked without authorization, how would you actually defend yourself in admissibility hearing? And so one more thing on this is that I did have one of my sort of like landmark kind of crazy cases was when I was at a port of entry with a client who was trying to get a work permit, and she helped her prospective employer to the bathroom in a wheelchair and helped him push his wheelchair. And they then called her out and said, "You just worked without authorization."
Holy smokes.
Yeah. And so that was like the case that I keep saying, like, you know, don't tell me that it's not possible, because we like, I fought, you know, at the board, I did a JR, like something, because of that act of helping this person in a wheelchair get to the bathroom at a port of entry. So there's a lot of gray area.
What did the board say?
So it was a very, very long time ago, but basically because at the board, it was just a question of whether or not there was unauthorized work. There was no ability to make any equitable arguments at the board. And essentially what ended up happening is that we ended up, because she was still within time to do restoration, so we ended up getting her restored before the matter ever had to get dealt with at the immigration division. So it became a moot point. But still, it was, but the board kind of, they basically gave us time to get a decision made on the restoration argument, because you could sort of tell that they didn't really want to have to deal with this as being a question of whether or not that was unauthorized work. So they just kind of, they adjourned the admissibility hearing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, it was quite.
And I think we've all seen like cases where there were allegations of unauthorized work that were either founded or not. So one of our former articling students once had to do an immigration division case where someone was accused of working without authorization because they were wearing their spouse's company shirt around town, but weren't actually working, or it wasn't established that they were working. So there's those evidentiary cases, but to hear like the case you're describing where there was an observation of someone pushing someone in a wheelchair, their prospective employer, I guess, and Yeah, technically that, I guess, would be providing care, but it seems way outside the scope of the intention of the law.
Mm-hmm. But that goes to show when clients ask, you know, well, will anybody find out or is anyone really going to care? These are the cautionary tales, right? These are the things as examples to say, the choice is yours, but I kind of have to come to you and say, this is what potentially could happen. You know, I advise against it, but no, these are the risks. So these are the examples we often use.
So we've talked about these risks. What are the actual risks? Like, what are the consequences of working without authorization?
Well, I mean, for the applicant, for the person that's alleged to have worked without authorization, I mean, they're going to be found non-compliant, inadmissible. If they're coming in, I mean, the case that Deanna was talking about, I mean, then you have the whole, you know, removal order, exclusion order. And there's been tons of those cases recently now with the flag polling. And I think we're all aware of them where they're coming in and say they came in as visitors and then flag polled and said your intention was different. You wanted to come in to work instead of coming in as a visitor. So, you know, we're all dealing with those cases in one way or another. So, I mean, it's exclusion from Canada, non-compliance and admissibility ultimately. And then depending on the level of non-compliance, the employer can also, I mean, there's also consequences under IRPA for the employer that has employed the person without authorization. So those are discussions.
Sorry to interrupt you, Christina. No, I'd love to dig into those because they're both very interesting points. Like in terms of the, because we've talked about both of these subjects on the podcast, and the one about the misrep allegation for those who've gone back to the port of entry. Are you finding that those are getting legs, any of those misrep claims? Because we've, I'll leave it at that.
The ones that I've been involved in, they haven't moved forward. As in one capacity or another, we've reached out or things have just kind of, as in your case, you talked about like a restoration application or whatnot, in one way or another, they've resolved themselves. I do know there are a bunch of cases that have moved forward. I think there was actually a recent case that was decided. I haven't had the opportunity to review it yet, but I think there was a decision that came down, if I'm not mistaken. But it was happening quite often. Like we were meeting clients all the time with the same issue.
Yeah, we saw a rush of those as well. And the one that I dealt with, they didn't end up getting their misrep finding. They didn't manage to secure the misrep allegation at the board, which was good. Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering whether or not that's not the case, that others are finding that the misrep allegation is sticking. And in that case, it was kind of prejudicial in the sense that there was already an LMIA at the time of the person's entering as a visitor. But, you know, and so we've talked about this kind of as a cautionary tale to others is that not to be coming in as a visitor with the ultimate intention of making a work permit application or, you know, at the very least of being clear on entry as a visitor, that there is a future intention to apply as a worker. That's something that we talked about previously. But I would be very interested and maybe, you know, in, you know, to hear from others who have had negative decisions coming down where the misrep allegation has stuck. I think, you know, Steve and I would both be interested in hearing whether or not that has occurred. But going on to the second part of it about maybe you can remind me what the second part of it was, because you said does anybody remember what the second piece of it? You said the part about the misrep one, and then you said the part about just a bit.
No. I mean, the consequences to the applicant and then
to the employer. To the employer. So this was one, too, that I just wanted to put out a general ask. Like, how many, like, have either of you seen a lot of cases where the consequences came down on the employer for employing the worker without authorization?
I've seen warnings. So I've seen, you know, CBSA enforcement, you know, going to these places of employment and, you know, having a discussion with the employer. And, you know, and talking to them and kind of, I guess, giving them pointers and letting them know what their obligations are. But I've not personally seen an employer actually prosecuted. I don't know.
What about you, Steve?
About prosecutions. Way back when I first started, there was a pizza chain downtown that I think got fined 70,000, some number that I think had a seven in it, 717 or 70,000 for employing foreign nationals without authorization. I think also last year, I don't remember if it was working without authorization or just in the wrong occupation, but do you remember there were a bunch of jockeys in Vancouver?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I do remember that. It was at the racetrack, right?
Yeah. And the border TV show, there was a raid on a construction site that was filmed. It does tend to happen. And then I've seen in employer compliance inspections, if somebody is not doing the duties that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
So we met with one company where they actually did get an administrative monetary penalty for somebody who was employed as a administrative assistant and they wanted to learn a little bit about the mechanic trade. So I think they were working like 5 hours a week just getting trained in that, and the employer wrote it and was being honest in their inspection response, and they got hit with a fine for it.
The reason I ask this is because employers often say to me, it's a two-pronged thing, because I often, like, when people come to me and they say, hey, I've been working without authorization, I always strongly urge the applicant to make an honest disclosure and request restoration of status. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the immediate reaction is, wait, what are the consequences going to be to me? And I feel very strongly that, like, making an honest disclosure and paying the restoration fee, I have not seen, and I think that the wording of the legislation makes very clear that if you've made the disclosure, you've paid the restoration fee, that you're secure in knowing that your status will be restored, because it's got, like, the mandatory language, the restoration shall be granted. And so I'm very confident about that. But then, of course, I get the kind of questioning about, well, what about the consequences to the employer? But I just, you know, I think that what we're describing is some, except for the example that you gave, Steve, about the, you know, training outside of the occupation, but the other ones where they're like systemic issues, where, like, repeatedly they're employing people without authorization, I haven't found that there have been consequences to employers. You know, I find that most of the time, the most severe consequences befalls the worker themselves, and mostly when they have not made a disclosure, but they've been caught red-handed, kind of. And that, you know, that's when I really think, that's why, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer that you go with a disclosure and a restoration rather than risk the misrepresentation, being caught. And then I feel like they go kind of full gangbusters after the person and go after them in removal proceedings. So I don't know if you guys have any.
I think historically that's been the case. I don't know if in the future, as the inspection regime is only 5-6 years old, and it seems to be growing, and there seems to be more resources dedicated to it. So that might change. It definitely seems to be the case that employee complaints can lead to inspections. So if an employee, for whatever reason, were to complain about an employer letting them work without authorization, and where I have seen that is where the employer decides not to pay the employee, and they say, well, we can't actually employ you, you don't have a work permit, whoopsies, it'll have to have been volunteer, which obviously is not the way the system is set up. And that leads to issues there. And then also with, I don't know if Ontario has something similar, but in British Columbia now has a licensing regime for employers that use the labor market impact assessment process. And so in theory, if an employer is caught having employed people without authorization, they could lose their license. That's also very new. Like, I think that regime only came in December 2020, and I don't even know if they've done any inspections yet or anything. But in theory, there could be more consequences to employers.
It seems a little bit like disconnected that on the one hand, I mean, I would say just in general, the whole notion of the restoration is a little bit hard to get your head around. And this is something that Mr. Justice von Finkenstein spoke about in a case that I argued many, many years ago, where like the whole, and he had some very good wording in this, where it's sort of like the whole notion of restoration is pretty bizarre in the sense that like, if you read the manual, it says like, you have violated the law. However, you know, you can just pay this money and restore your status and all is right, you know? And so it's a very strange kind of a situation, but also that it's kind of trying to elicit, it's set up that it can elicit a confession of unauthorized work, but if it's set up so that it would then penalize the employer for having done something, again, it just sort of feels like the departments are working at cross purposes in a way. And maybe that's not cross purposes. Maybe that's just what they want to do. But, you know, I've found, especially when you're talking about, you know, caregivers and employers, like it does set up a very negative dynamic where an employer will be like, hey, I don't want you to disclose this because I'm afraid of the consequences to me. And then the caregiver will not disclose it. And then they might get caught or, you know, like, you know, it's just, it's unfortunate that there isn't a more kind of like, you know, even in the context of like EI benefits, if you accidentally receive EI benefits and then you're saying, hey, or if you haven't paid, you know, that there are sort of things built in where making that admission will mitigate your liability in some way. Mm-hmm. I guess there is something like that set up in the compliance regime, but it's not quite as formalized. Is there not something set up where like, if you've come to them and admitted that you have made some violation, that it's supposed to be, you're supposed to be treated a bit more?
Yeah. I mean, you won't get as many points when they're tallying up the score to use against you. So, I mean, and it's funny because as we're talking about this between the employee or the worker and the employer, that's usually when the issues of non-compliance start coming up because there's some agreement that was done between them. And then the relationship in some way or another, you know, deteriorates, something happens. And then, you know, both of them are like, well, what are the consequences to me? So, I mean, as representatives, I think, you know, anytime we're starting off that relationship, doing work permits, advising, there has to be a clear discussion about, you know, this is you as a worker, what you have to do. This is you as an employer, what you have to do, and your ongoing obligations. Because I think that clears things up because everyone, they get caught up in actually getting the work permit, but not understanding what everybody's obligations are. So that's an important thing to keep in mind for and all representatives, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
So let's switch gears into the types of work that you are explicitly authorized to do without a work permit. And these are set out in section 186 of the regulations, and as well as 187 to a degree. And why don't we start both, you know, your book, Christina, as well as the IRCC website has just lists with 186 has sections A through X, and we're not gonna do all 24, I can't remember how many letters that would get
there's,
us to.
There's quite a few.
But why don't we start with 186A, which is probably the main one, the business visitors. How do you summarize, like if a client asks, what is a business visitor?
Well, business visitor, when they ask me, and again, I'll use the example of the CEO of a company. If you're coming in to do a business visit, you're just coming in to do a simple meeting. You're meeting people, just talking about something, business meetings, or, you know, you're meeting with a potential client, fine. If you start signing the contracts, if you start, you know, doing some of the items that are outlined in the contract, then that's work. We've crossed the line. So, I mean, if it's, and as IRCC says, and the regulations say, if it's international in scope, fine. If we start getting into the nitty gritties of things, then we're doing work. So the classic example for me is someone who's maybe wanting to start a business here in Canada. So open up a branch of their, you know, let's say their US company. when you're coming in to set that up and meeting with, let's say, us as immigration counsel, with, you know, a real estate, someone to try and find, you know, to secure premises for the company, to meet with potential investors, that that encompasses the scope of a business visitor. But once that company's set up and all of that's done, and then you're coming in the capacity of a CEO of that company, and then you're starting to work and starting to, you know, on the day-to-day operation of that company, that's when we've crossed over to the work aspect of things. So that's the classic example I use with my clients is.
Is this where like training, like participating in company training or even conducting company training, does this fit in under business visitors?
Yeah. So that's 187.
Okay.
So 187 defines business visitors. I just pulled it up. So it's for a business visitor to Canada as a foreign national who is described in section 2, or who seeks to engage in international business activities in Canada without directly entering the Canadian labor market.
Right.
And then section 2 says these three types of people are business visitors, people who enter Canada, foreign nationals who enter Canada to purchase Canadian goods or services for use by the foreign business, or receive training or familiarization in respect of such goods or services. And then B, I think, is the broad one, the most expansive one, which is foreign nationals receiving or giving training within a Canadian parent or subsidiary of the corporation mm-hmm. that employs them outside Canada, mm-hmm. as long as the production of any goods is incidental. And then the third is people representing businesses or governments for the purpose of selling goods for that business or government, as long as they aren't selling to the general public.
Mm-hmm. So, and the other one that people don't seem to, like, just it's a question that I get a lot, like, can I come in and look for a job? You know, I think people think that that is automatically a violation to come in and look for work. So mm-hmm. I do get that question a fair bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where that does get complicated are where interviews might have a hands-on component.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to happen, or where I see it happen, where there are issues, is in the trucking industry, where they'll say, okay, well, go drive that truck over there and we'll see like if you can do it. And it starts to get very blurry as to whether they're now working or is this part of an interview or what exactly is it? Hmm. The other one that people ask are board of directors. So if you own, and this might even warrant its own topic for a couple minutes, is we talked about self-employment, but what can you own a company without working at the company?
Go ahead.
Oh, it's just on the IRCC website, you're allowed to attend board of directors meetings mm-hmm. is the scope of what 186 allows. But then in practice, Canada regulates just the actual work, not ownership of companies under immigration law.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Which is then the other, I mean, another question that people ask is, and Canadian companies will ask is, can I employ someone abroad on a contract basis, or do they need a work permit? Like, I don't know if you've ever gotten that question, because especially in a work from home world, like, you know, Canadian companies will hire people on contract basis from all over the world. The answer is no, that immigration law only cares in this context about what people are doing when they're physically in Canada.
In Canada, yeah.
And there is an interesting labor market issue, I guess, of like, you know, that we don't care. The Canadian immigration law doesn't mind if a Vancouver-based company hires someone in California to work in California for that company doing software development. But as soon as they move to BC, that's where there's big immigration hurdles that arise.
Yeah, and that's what every client is astonished by. So when we answer that question, it's okay. They're like, really? Are you sure? Like, this is what we're doing. And they'll ask for verification over and over again. And we say, yes, you're okay. But, you know, you've identified it perfectly, Stephen, that it seems a bit counterintuitive to the, you know, to why we need work permits and all of that. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the other authorization to works, I mean, it could, like, foreign representatives, military personnel, government officers, 186F on-campus employment. So people who are attending school here can work on campus without a work permit. And it's interesting just the legislative history of how that came before off-campus work. And I don't know what the historic rationale for why a student can work full-time on campus. You know, they can work up to 40 hours a week on campus. But as soon as they, depending on where the school is, cross the street, if it's U of T and work at the Starbucks across the street or off-campus, then they're limited to 20 hours and then full-time during regularly scheduled like school breaks. Do you know where that historic divide comes from or what?
I don't know, but I would imagine it's because of the degree to which, you know, students will do kind of work under a particular professor and end up getting paid for doing research and that sort of thing and just not wanting to have to limit that or confine the amount of hours they would be able to do that work. And I imagine, you know, it's important to the research and, you know, to the development of the faculty to have, you know, the good students be able to support the, you know, the research and, you know, the faculty development and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. And so it just would have been
PAs and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Although I think it includes, like, on their website, on-campus employers includes those businesses who serve the general public as long as the place of business is located on the institution's campus.
Yeah.
So that Starbucks could be on campus.
Or yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Across the street and not. So that's
where it gets weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, Deanna, what you've said makes the most sense. I mean, they're going to limit research is an unlimited endeavor. So they don't want to limit that. That would make complete sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have our foreign nationals, the performing artists, the guest artists, WWE is specifically listed as people who can come in.
Amazing.
Artist, air show individuals. I remember there was a big debate over people playing at bars. And I don't remember off the top of my head how that resolved. It's not on the IRCC
website. Oh no, there it is. So people, for example, if a couple, actually we used to get this question a lot, was if a couple hires a band to perform at their wedding, there is no employment relationship created even where contracts are signed. However, if a dinner theater hires a foreign singer or dancer to perform five nights a week on a weekly basis, then there is an LMIA that's needed. Contracts for short gigs do not create an employment relationship, and therefore they can enter without a work permit. This really gets to that, like, you know, lawyerly answer of it depends.
It depends, exactly.
Whether they need a work permit or not.
Yeah, and what we always tell clients are, and I mean, we've provided as a practice tip in the book, is just to talk about the frequency. So if it's like a one-time, you know, deal, that's fine. Even like the example of the, you know, WWE, you know, you're just coming in for that one night, it's fine. But if you're going to be like an ongoing guest, then, you know, or an ongoing performer, then you're going to have to get the work permit. So there's, we get those questions a lot too, with, you know, different artists that are coming in just for something, or even, you know, speakers at special events, like guest lectures and stuff like that. So because they're exempt.
I would say with all of the work permit exemptions, like, I think sometimes clients will do these searches and they'll be like, oh, yippee, like I'm subject to an exemption. Amazing. But it's like, they've all got almost more fine print than they do. Like, the exemptions are, none of them are broad. They're all extremely narrow exemptions, and they have to be looked at with a very fine tooth comb. So like the performing artist one, like, and the public speaker one that you mentioned, I think those are really good examples of like where you have to like really read in and be like, you know, does this actually apply to this particular set of circumstances? Because it's,
Well, because that's what the officer will do too, is they're going to go to the website and just start reading through it.
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, how about if I push the events? That's my favorite question, is how about if I push the events over like a calendar year? Would I still be able to use the exemption? And I'm like, again, it's that thing of it depends, right? But I'm like, if you know at this point that you're going to be coming back frequently, then no, this doesn't apply to you. But, you know, if it comes up that as of today's date, you only know that you're coming the one time, and then 4 months from now, another event comes in, then, you know, that's more likely to fall within the exemption. So I always love when clients like pose the alternatives, and you kind of have to play CBSA officer / lawyer at the same time.
Well, that public speaker one. So you've got, you know, the event must not last longer than 5 days.
Yeah.
So you get into like, is that a firm rule? Is that interpretive? Seminar is a small class at a university or a short intensive course. Commercial speakers have a vested interest in the event. Typically they rent commercial space. If they're doing this for no more than 5 days on one trip, they can enter. It also covers situations where there are, someone is speaking at multiple groups, as long as the duration of all the speaking events is no more than 5 days, not counting travel time. Not included, or is it not included, are, and this I think is one that really confuses people.
Yeah,
best
for
instructors
sure.
of a particular sport coming to
exactly
weekend seminars. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's, well, what's the difference between a guest inspector or guest instructor and a public speaker? What is a sport? What is a seminar?
Yes.
But you wouldn't, it all just, that person who's just reading through the website, not getting into the fine print, would just read, oh, public speakers, that's me.
Yeah,
exactly.
And they have made these incredibly complicated.
Yeah, it is. And the type of question that we get a lot here on the West Coast is like, well, is yoga and meditation, is that fitness, you know, or is that wellness, you know? And so, so again, these are not perfectly contained boxes by any means. They're very interpretive. This is maybe a good point to just kind of to give a general explanation as to how these applications are made and what you know, what is the user experience in terms of making such an application, and, you know, what kind of transparency do they have? So they call you, they ask for an opinion, you're like, here's my opinion. And then what is the actual experience for the applicant?
Well, I mean, the actual experience for the applicant is, it depends on what, you know, if they're from a visa required country or not. So, I will be honest, when you explain to a client that they're going to have to submit something like this to the visa post, and there's going to, you know, they're going to need an approval before they come in and all of that, these types of events sometimes don't have enough lead time. So when we explain this process to them, they're kind of like, okay, you know, maybe not this time, we'll set it up for next year. And then for visa, for non visa exempt people, they can just do it at the port of entry. And then, but you're having that CVSA officer. So much of the questions that I'm asking when we're doing the assessment are the exact questions that the examining officer is going to do at the port of entry. And then clients are like, I get it all the time. They're like, but do you want to help me? I said, I absolutely want to help you. That's why I'm asking you these questions, because if we don't have answers to them, then, you know, you're going to lose money on the event. You're going to have lost the travel, you know, costs and everything. So, I mean, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right to begin with. And officers, it also depends, as we all know, it depends on the officer you get. It depends on the port of entry, crossing. There's so many, there's so many factors, but yeah, for us,
for it's sure. And then throw
boxes
in a pandemic, and that's
well,
amazing.
Yeah. And then let's put in a strike now, a potential, a looming strike. And then,
yes, that's right. Of course. Yeah. The port of entry strike. That's going to be amazing.
So we have lots of factors.
The other thing to on that note of how you apply for this is whether, if you're already in Canada, can you just do these activities without having to get advanced approval? And so where this arises, last year, 2019, we submitted a work permit application for a religious leader, which is going to be our next work permit exempt category. And it was actually refused on the basis that they had already started working on what the officer called a V1 visa and not a specific worker visa. And ultimately, the judicial review was successful, and it was successful through settlement. So you sometimes wonder, you know, what does the settlement actually stand for, any principle, or why exactly did it settle? But I took at least one interpretation of the settlement, and certainly my arguments, to mean that you don't have to have a specific visa to work, or you don't have to get, if you are in Canada as a visitor and you get offered a job as a, or a gig as a public speaker, you don't have to exit the country and re-enter and make it clear that you're working now as a public speaker. I shouldn't say working. Well, I guess it is work without a work permit.
Yeah.
Working as a public speaker. So I don't know if that's your opinion as well, that you don't need advanced approval for any of these. And even if you're in Canada, if you get offered a job as a rabbi, you could just start working as a rabbi.
Yeah, I mean, I would be in agreement with you. And I mean, the discussion we get all the time, as you've said before, it's, you're coming in under, you know, 186 work without a work permit, and then you're doing, let's say, extending your status. And a lot of the times, you know, the discussion comes, well, should I change it? And I, you know, there was a refusal once where they were here I believe it was an imam, and they were here, and then they wanted to make the change to a work permit for the simple purpose of eventually applying for permanent residency. And then the application got refused because for the exact same reasons you've identified, by basically saying, well, you were here as a visitor, now you want to work, you know, pick which one it is. And it's like, well, actually it's both, because both, like, those documents allow for both. It's just, you know, we have the exemption, or you can get the work permit under, you know, the C50. So it was, I forget how it ultimately ended, because I may have transferred the file at some point. I don't remember the outcome, but the frustration you've identified is definitely there, because it just, it's like they don't it's lost in translation or mm-hmm. in interpreting the regulations.
Mm-hmm. The other part about the the strategy thing that I think gets confusing when it comes to advising clients. First of all, one experience that I've had is that oftentimes when clients come to our office, it's because they've been doing something for a while and all yeah. of a sudden they stop being able to do it. So like they've yeah. been coming in to do public speaking or to come to meetings and all of a sudden they start getting refused or their employees start getting refused or whatever. And then they start saying, can I do this? And how do I do this? And whatever. Mm-hmm. So the point that I wanted to make was about when you're like about the use of the temporary foreign worker units. I don't think they're called that anymore. IMWU or something like that. Isn't that what mm-hmm, they're called mm-hmm. now?
Yeah.
I'm just curious as to whether or not you recommend that people use the IMWU for opinions about this or whether or not you think people are better off just going directly and just maybe because I've just gone to it, but just explain what this is about and whether or not you recommend people use this.
Yeah, and I'll be a lawyer here and I'll say it depends.
Yeah.
and I mean, it really depends on, you know, who the client is, how much documentation you have, you know, how much lead time you have and how nervous the client might be.
Because totally.
some clients are like, Christina, I'm not willing to give it a go. Like, I'm like, you know, dealing with the border officials causes me severe anxiety. I just want something that says I'm okay. So I know when I get on that plane, I'm not going to have to talk very much. And then other times it's basically, you know, in my opinion, it's not worth going to the unit because it's pretty, you know, black and white. It also depends on how big the project is, right? Because if it's that one that's a gray area and, you know, there's going to be tons of money involved in a particular project and, you know, so many moving parts, sometimes just having that pre-approval and that opinion in hand, you know, gives the client some assurity, and it also, you know, for ourselves knows that, okay, someone agrees that they're exempt or, you know, they're eligible for the work permit so we can move forward. So it really depends, but some of them you don't want the unit looking at, right. Or not, but just because I find sometimes there's a lot of follow-up questions that may lead to misunderstanding. And then when you don't have when you already have a negative opinion in the file, then that signals to the border officer, okay, someone's already looked at this.
And you're coming anyways. Yeah.
And you're coming anyways. Now I've seen the outcome go both ways. I've seen it where they've said, well, the unit has said no, and I'm going to stand by that. And I've seen other times where they're just like, no, I think you meet the definition. So let's proceed. So it really, again, it's that depends piece that we always say.
I tend to use the unit where it's important that everyone get the same decision. And I find them to be really quick and good on group decisions. Generally, I like and I'm curious maybe to know your thoughts on this as well. Generally, I prefer CBSA to IRCC when it comes to decision-making because there's a face-to-face interaction. And unlike with IRCC where they'll just, if they have a question, they legally can just say, well, insufficient evidence. Mm-hmm. At CBSA, an officer will always ask the question and mm-hmm. you have you're nodding along, Christina, and I guess you feel the same, that ability to have the interview is almost like procedural fairness is at the highest at CBSA, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I tend to just prefer that an IMWU is emails, and I just prefer face-to-face, especially if someone's fluent in English and able to express themselves well, to certainly an online PDF where there's no interaction before a faceless bureaucrat or just emails.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I also feel that the border officers, especially in like border towns, they understand, as I say, the business, right? Or they understand how businesses work and, you know, what is going on. So I find they're, you know, they ask the right types of questions. So that's generally why I also prefer just sending them directly to the border and have an officer make that decision.
And we touched on it a little bit, but religious work is, you mentioned the C50 exemption code. So people who are religious workers don't need an LMIA. It's sort of unique in that the IRCC website says, if you're a religious worker, you can get a work permit or you don't have to have a work permit. It's kind of up to you.
Exactly.
I don't know why. I've kind of been surprised that the work permit exemption continues to exist, considering there is a very flexible work permit option. I don't know why you're still able to work as a religious worker without a work permit. I'm sure there is a reason. I don't know if any of you can think of what it might be, but.
We just know we advise. I mean, there's pros and cons to either of them. So it's kind of, we leave it to the client to decide. I mean, when you're doing the LMI, when you're doing the work permit, obviously there's all the issues related to the employer portal, employer mm-hmm. compliance, that sort of stuff. And then when you're doing the visitor record or the exemption, those factors aren't really considered. So,
yeah,
I mean, you know, those are different things.
I don't know how it works in Ontario regarding healthcare for people on visitor records. Mm. Like, are they entitled to whatever the, like, we call it MSP here. I don't know. OHIP? Are they entitled to OHIP?
I believe they are, yeah. And as long as it's over the 6-month period, yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so I think that's a distinction in BC. Visitors aren't entitled to MSP. So especially in BC, it's like the advantage of having the work permit is clear. Interestingly enough, what's now, I think, possibly unique in BC is if you're a child and you're here on a study permit, you have to pay MSP, but if you're here on a visitor record, you don't. So there's monthly premiums in BC. And I think BC might be unique for its monthly premiums system that the New Democrat government here recently got rid of, but it continues for international student. And international, the student is defined as someone with a study permit, whereas people on visitor records do not need them. Flipping through some of these other specific ones, judges, referees, healthcare students, civil aviation crew, emergency service providers is one that comes up somewhat occasionally if you're dealing with a community that has had an emergency and they need to get people in. And then implied status, which I saw was recently named maintained status, mm-hmm. not uniformly updated on the IRCC website. And I think, Deanna, you've been to federal court on, am I wrong? Right? You had an implied.
I feel like I've probably been to federal court many times on implied status, but I'm not sure I can think of what particular case is, but I just feel like I live in the land of implied status.
Yeah. And that is that if you, well, do you want to say the basic 2-sentence summary of maintained status, as it's now called?
Yeah, just that if you have applied to extend your status prior to the expiration of your current status, you maintain that status until a decision is made on the new application.
Yeah. And so you can continue to work.
You basically maintain the conditions of your prior permit until the new decision is rendered.
Yeah. And that's the key.
Yeah, you can't start your new job if you have a new job, but you can continue in your old job.
Yeah, it just holds. It's like a holding pattern for that old permit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Off-campus work, we touched on a bit. And then there's W, which is the transition to post-graduation status. Mm-hmm. And there's been
Super weird one. Oh my God, that is a super weird one. I feel like that one is a bit of a dog's breakfast, that post-grad work permit. There are lots of things to say there. Yeah.
We could do a whole episode on how for the federal court, especially, and I know your firm's familiar with this from some of the early cases, like the federal court seems to treat postgraduate work permits amongst the strictest in how it's interpreted, and especially when mm-hmm. it comes to restoration to a postgrad work permit. But then the area that you're talking to with this being complicated, Deanna, is that when it is that, like, you can work when you're on a scheduled break full-time in your last semester.
It's that. It's like that you cannot work the moment you graduate until the moment that you apply.
Yeah.
Nobody understands that. So people that are in jobs that they actually are supposed to stop working until they've applied for their post-grad work permit, but they can't apply for their post-grad work permit until they get their transcript. So the delay of the school in issuing their permit render, and then people don't know that, and then they're terrified to disclose this period of unauthorized work, and they're worried about the consequences of that, and then they're worried that they've misrepresented themselves because they didn't know that it anyway. So it's just all that, but also it's like the timing of how long you have to apply for your post-grad work permit, because again, this is one of those that might seem to be straightforward. But sometimes people, like, let's say, for example, you've switched schools and you've obtained, you know, you've done some courses here and you've done some courses there. And then, you know, I've had a number of people who've actually, like, sometimes people, they switch schools, and this happened a lot around the pandemic where, like, schools shut down. And then I've had people go back to previous schools and realize they actually had enough credits to actually get a lesser diploma than the one that they were working toward. But then... does that prevent them from actually applying for the post-grad work permit off of that prior diploma because too much time has gone by? Like, there's just, again, it's just, these ones are very, very ambiguous when you get into sort of more non-straightforward cases. And because it's all in policy, it just gets super confusing and overwhelming for people to try and figure out how to navigate.
I know. And I feel for the foreign students because, I mean, they're starting... I mean, I'm thinking about myself at 17 years old, right?
Oh my goodness.
I mean, not only are you starting at like education, you're moving to a different country. You basically have to know exactly what you want to do and be on the right track and just commit to that from the moment you enter Canada, and hope everything goes well and you don't struggle and you don't have anything go on, because that's really the only way the post-grad is going to work for you. Or if, you know, you invest additional money and continuing your education, and, you know, your parents probably spent all their money just to send you to do this, you know, 2-year college diploma. So, I mean,
There's a lot of pressure on these young people.
Yeah.
There are a couple of other things. Like, let's say you've done a 1-year degree and then you get your 1-year post-grad permit and then you go back to school and you do a 2-year degree, but you've burned your 1 year.
Exactly.
Post-grad. Why can't they just give you the second, like the two balance of the 2 years? Like, I just don't understand why that is. I just don't understand the policy. It's like you get one for lifetime. It doesn't matter that you now... You know, I could imagine saying a 3-year max, like that's it.
Yeah.
That's all you can ever get. But to say like you know, because a lot of people, they don't know. They get their 1-year diploma, they get their 1-year thing, they earn enough money that they go back to school, and to say now your shot is done, I just don't understand.
For me, it's full-time status requirement.
That one, I just go crazy.
So if you're in your final year and you want to go and you have you're in your last year and you can choose, I want my winter semester to be part-time or my spring semester. Maybe I want to ski a lot in the winter. Not allowed. I also don't understand why.
Or you get
why,
sick,
like, if they
or
get rid
you
of that,
have
you
an injury or like, and I understand that there are leave of absence provisions, but they're not as easy to navigate as it might seem. They're really not.
And the student really has to know what to ask for, what to do, what to, I mean, we've dealt with so many of those where I'm just like, we can't do anything for you. And then we'll apply, let's maybe even say like a TRP, right, with a work permit. And you try to explain this to someone and hope they understand. But like, good luck.
Yeah.
9 months, 12 months later, you get a decision on that application.
Exactly.
Like, one of those really things, like, too, that I would automate. Like, I don't understand why it can't just be the school hits on like their portal. This guy graduated, this person graduated.
Here's
automatic
your permit.
3-year work permit. Like, it's
that's it.
Yeah, that's it. And even just how like how people really are still being recruited to schools without understanding that this is not a post-grad eligible school. There's one more that I got that was another frustration for me about this, about co-op terms. I've found that a lot of schools, they'll say like your max, like you have to, in order to maintain full-time status, you have to have 8 80 credits per term. Mm-hmm. I'm just making up a number. But co-op terms are considered 20 credits, but they're obviously still considered full-time status. But unless you put in document that now I got this because somebody came to me after a refusal, now I put in documentation from the school that says, even though your co-op term is only 20 credits, here's the documentation from the school that says you're still considered full-time. Because I had IRCC refuse a post-grad work permit for somebody on the basis that it was only 20 credits during that term.
Yeah.
They were working like crazy. But well, again, also, like, a student doesn't know to put in the whole school's policy saying a co-op term is full-time. So they lost status and they were out of work for like 6 months while waiting for a restoration. It's just like, it's really stressful.
It's an exceptional burden to put on students. Like there's already so much pressure trying to find. And then that's not like, you know, going back to your point before, Deanna, just talking about, you know, that period of time from when you're finished your schooling and then when your employer wants to hire you. I mean, we're pushing to say we need a younger workforce. We need to recruit out of university, out of colleges. That just makes an employer completely turned off by the whole concept of, you know, recruiting out of college and university. So it drives me. Like, I just feel for these students. And then there's the exceptional pressure of making sure you have a job lined up right after graduation, because that's your shot to get PR. So, I mean, I feel for them. I really do.
That's going to be a whole episode on
students.
The other one is the trimester system. If you're like, that's probably where I see the most confusion at CBSA and people coming into the office, because they were told you weren't always a full-time student. And you know what I mean by the these schools that operate on like a three trimester system. And the first thing that I always think when I look at their transcripts is, oh, it's a three trimester system. I'm going to have to go look up how this works again. And I think that's what causes confusion at CBSA as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Deanna, I know you have to go in 4 minutes.
I do.
We've kind of hit everything except
I don't know anything about global skill strategy. So you're
basically
just as well
the way
without
I describe
me.
It is IRCC said, you know what? You want to work in Canada in a skilled position for 1 month, go for it. That's basically like the one, although I don't know if it's all skilled. I think it's just knock zero and eight.
But isn't there still that issue of like, and again, I only hear about other people complaining about this because I don't do this stuff, but isn't there still the issue of not knowing whether they've let you in under the global still strategy? And if so, when, and I'm like, and so like for people to track, like, you know, what actually happened, and for employers to ensure that their workers were actually given this exemption to make sure they're being compliant, like that it's like, you know, there's like all sorts of, you know, they're not actually issued something that says,
no, you have to beg in some instances that a visitor record gets issued, because they don't have to, right? So it's like, when we give packages, it's written all over the package. We have prep calls with the applicant and say, please ask, don't leave. And I remember I had a call once on a Sunday evening and the client's like, the officer's not giving it to me. And I was like, they're not allowing you entry. He's like, no, he's not giving me that document that you want. And you told me not to leave if I don't give you the document. So I was like, okay. So we had to have a discussion with the officer. But yeah, it's definitely, that's the frustration, because you don't know. As counsel, we basically say you have to track these things for compliance. You have to track them, but then, you know, they're not always getting it. So
I could see the officer, like from the CBSA officer's position, it's probably a pain and a delay to print a permit.
Yeah.
And they're probably saying, well, normally we grant people 6 months to be a visitor. We're doing that here. You're only coming for 1 month. Why do you need a piece of paper?
Exactly.
And yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's what employers have all been told.
Well, there should be something then that's like a work permit exemption. Like, I think that that's maybe just an overall comment, that for people to have like something to hold on to that says this is the exemption that has been granted to you. Like, you know, I know that if I were doing this, maybe I'm more uptight than the average person, but I would like to have something in my hand that said this is a document that permits me to do the thing that I'm doing. So
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Don't think that's,
I mean, it's a great program, and it deals with all the situations where you don't fit into the exemptions that we just talked about, and it allows workers to come in for the temporary project. In theory and practice, in that regard, it's fantastic. It's just the frustration is that document, and I think that's something they're going to have to, you know, eventually implement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool.
And just to correct my... Okay, sorry, go ahead.
No, go. What were you going
to
correct?
To correct myself, when I had said previously about, you had indicated about the religious workers, they're not actually entitled because there are certain ones that allow you to be entitled to OHIP and they're not one of them. So the same considerations happen here in Ontario, I suppose, with the OHIP coverage.
Okay, awesome. Well, I think we've covered it all off.
Everything.
Deanna wants documents to carry on her at all times.
Yeah, please.
And on that that note, yeah, maybe we'll do round two for post-grad work permits and all the issues there.
Definitely a hot topic.
Thanks for coming on, Christina. I don't know if you have material for a future book now or... whenever you next.
I'm still recovering from the first.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we should put in a plug on our, when we post this episode, with a link to where we can find Christina's book.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. Thank you.
All right.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.